Ladies and gentlemen, are you ready for the dawn of America
of America Audio with your host, Tim Banal.
No commercials, no subscriptions, no network, no rules, and no shows in August. What's going on all with all that? BOA Audio is back, folks. I apologize for the missing in action situation. It really just kind of all came together accidentally, and as I was saying to Richard here before we went on the air, the show has really evolved into this guerrilla programming style of show. And, you know, when August comes around, as the longtime listeners of the program should know, I really just turned into a terrible paranormal radio host. I'd rather sit around the fire pit and drink beers than host a radio show at the time. And now that September's behind us and Labor Day's behind us, the summer's behind us, we're back with more BOA Audio, the final five episodes here of Season 8. And as I'm lashing myself about being so lazy over the summer, we got a guy on the program here tonight who is the opposite of that. He's amazingly prolific. He is the host of The Conspiracy Show, which you can hear Sunday nights, 11 p.m. to 1 a.m. on AM 740 up in Canada and on a whole bunch of stations. Just check out the affiliate list at richardsorette.com. I'm kind of giving away the guest here because it is, of course, Richard Sorette. I've had the opportunity to work with him over the summer and spring and really got to know him pretty well, and I think he's a fantastic guy. He's a lot like me in a way. He really has a wide variety of different interests in this whole esoteric milieu, from Bigfoot and UFOs and conspiracy theories, of course, and all the sort of weird little side roads and tangents you can explore. So we're going to get into all that tonight here on the program. It's a real thrill to have him on the show, and he's a baseball fan, so he's already a friend of the program, of course, because finding someone who's into the paranormal and baseball is kind of a hard Venn diagram to accomplish, but we've done it a few times here on the program. So welcome to the show, Richard Sorette. Sorry for the long introduction, but folks have been waiting to hear from me for the last month, and they've been really emailing me and stuff and looking forward to hearing from you,
Tim,
and me as well.
Great to be here. I appreciate the offer. Thank you. I'd love to sit around a campfire and drink a few wobbly pops with you likewise.
Anytime, Richard, anytime. Now, as I said, I've kind of started to get to know you through working with you on Coast to Coast, and bring the BOA Audio listeners up to speed. Tell us, who is Richard Sorette? Give us your bio, your background, so we can really dig into all this.
Well, let's go back to the campfire for a moment. I guess we're like-minded in that there's probably nothing I'd rather do pretty well all the time than sit around a campfire. And so maybe that's why I gravitated towards radio. I look at radio as sort of the electronic bonfire, and it's, you know, it's where we gather to tell stories now. So I first began producing talk radio in the early 90s, and then eventually by the late 90s found myself behind a microphone at a 50,000-watt station up in Toronto, CFRB, which has been on the air since, I think, 1927. And between 1927 and now, I think the station has had a total of three morning men.
Oh, wow.
Wally Crowder, I think, holds the world's record for the longest-serving morning men. He was there for like 60 years. So I grew up on radio, learning from and working with some real luminaries up here in Canada. And then when I found myself behind the microphone, I had to figure out how am I going to fill, I think it was 3 hours on a Sunday night originally. Mm. And I didn't want to talk about garbage strikes and municipal elections, and there were, you know, countless of other people doing it already and doing probably a much better job than I could. So I gravitated towards the things that I've always been interested in since I could remember, the big questions. Why are we here? What happens after we die? Are we alone in the universe? What's that sound, in the stomping around in the woods? Who's running the show? I started to do that on the air, and bit by bit and gradually it took over, and then as often happens, it sort of took over my life, and that eventually led, this is the Reader's Digest version, eventually led to a television show of the same name, but a half-hour format, documentary style, that airs across Canada on Vision TV, and we just this week, I believe, through PPI releasing, are now available in the U.S.
Nice.
I believe 52 episodes, and I think we're starting out with about 40 markets across the U.S.
Oh, wow, nice.
And back in 2009, I got a call from, at the time, it was Trevor Oliver, who was the vice president of talk programming at Premier, a fellow Canuck. He was from Montreal, and he asked me, would I like to fill in for George Norrie, who on a Friday night, who was celebrating his daughter's birthday. And that was like getting a call up to the Yankees. I did that show in 2009, and it was a thrill. I never expected to get a call back, and there was a bit of a dry spell. I started again in January of this year doing some more coast fill-in, and which is just, you know, it's kind of one of those pinch me moments every time I go on the air on Coast, just because of the legendary antecedents to this program.
Absolutely.
That's sort of the radio TV side of the conspiracy show. And I have a couple other irons in the fire, some live events that I'm getting involved in, and I teach part-time at a school for media art and design just east of Toronto. And other than that, just running around, chauffeuring my twin boys to school and piano lessons and regular dad stuff.
Exactly, yeah. Well, see, yeah, it's just refreshing that you have the balance between having a normal human life and being mixed up in all this. Because, as you said, it does take over your life. It's a rabbit hole. Once you go down it, it changes your vision of reality sometimes.
Yeah, there was a time just after my boys were born, and they're going to be 8 in October. But just after they were born, I thought I got to get away from this. So I decided to try and do a quote normal talk show, talking about the garbage strike and municipal budgets, and my heart was not in it. I tried. I gave it the old college try, but it's true. You can't go back. I guess it's. Going back to, I heard rumors, people that took acid, the doors of perception, right? But once that's opened, you can't go back. Nothing is the same. But you do need the balance. I know someone up here in Toronto on the air who talks about the Illuminati every Saturday night for 3 hours. No guests, no calls.
Oh, wow.
Which is a real feat. I mean, I admire that. But I knew he was a colleague at another radio station, and he would trap you in the hall, and there was 20 minutes you'd never get back, because he would just lived it and breathed it 24/7. And I felt bad for him, because again, no balance. Certainly dedicated to the craft and everything, but I can't live my life that way.
Yeah, absolutely. Because it's a troubling. I've struggled with this on the show here at times, too. It's, I often say, it's like, if there really is this grand conspiracy, I don't see how we can get out of this mess we found ourselves in, the average person. Like, it's over, If everything Alex Jones says is true, then it's done. It's over. We've lost. I find myself in that kind of state sometimes. I mean, I continue onward to try and get the word out and talk about it and sort of analyze what's happening. But at the same time, it's a very daunting... it's not like we're both baseball fans. It's not like being a baseball fan. It's not the end. It sucks if the Blue Jays or the Red Sox don't make the playoffs, but it's not the end of the world. You don't lose. But in this realm, it's like, like I said, if everything Alex Jones is saying, or some of these conspiracy folks are saying, it's like, we've lost, man. It's scary, scary stuff.
Yeah, it would appear that this elite cabal has everything locked down, and hence Alex Jones' term, the prison planet. We are living in a prison planet, and not to get overtly religious, but I mean, I run everything through my faith filter. So, I mean, for me personally, I know ultimately the good guys win. Mm. So I sort of hold on to that. And then between, you know, here and the apocalypse, there's always, you know, baseball. There's always baseball, which is a healthy diversion. And I'm sort of gravitating towards back to baseball, took the boys to see a Yankees game and see Derek Jeter play before he hangs them up. And I realize how the importance of these little diversions, as long as they remain diversions and not obsessions. But we need them. Otherwise, we'd go crazy. We'd shoot our brains out.
Exactly. Well, I'm going to formally invite you into the league of baseball specialists here on the show. So we have to get you back in touch this spring to compete with Lauren Coleman and Rich Dolan and Adam Gorightly in the baseball predictions contest.
I didn't know that Rich Dolan was a ball fan. I'm very fond of Richard. He's a delightful, learned man, and I always enjoy speaking with him. But I didn't know that he was a ball fan.
Oh, yeah, now, big time.
Let's see. He's in Rochester. That used to be the AAA team for Baltimore, but I'm not sure. That's probably changed.
Yeah, I'm not sure. I only know the Syracuse Sky Chiefs because I went to school up there.
That's right.
I'm hearing a weird sort of sound when you talk a little bit, like sleigh bells or something in the background, but I don't know if it's like a shh sound, but I don't know if it's...
No, they are sleigh bells. This is the North Pole. I'm not sure what that is. I'm holding a very large glass of water.
Are you on speakerphone?
I am. Do you want me to turn that off? I'm trying to keep I'm on a mobile, and I'm trying to keep my brain cells intact, so...
All right, well, we'll survive. Don't worry about it. We'll survive. As long as it's kind of one of those things, if I acknowledge it, then people will they'll refrain from emailing me about it. You know what I mean?
All right.
I once had a rooster in the background at Jim Mars' place, and it was like, finally halfway through the interview, I was like, is that a rooster? Just, you know, I gotta get that off the table here. Is that a rooster in the background? Which it was.
Of course. Sure.
Yeah.
Well, isn't live radio grand? I was in Grants Pass, Oregon. Shout out to Lisa Lyon, who lives there. We were doing an episode of the TV show, and we had just returned. We were on our way back from Olympia, Washington, where I had been interviewing Andrew Bishago about time travel, and we had to get back to L.A. To catch a flight home. And but I had to stop en route because I had to do my Sunday night show, and I had my mixer and my, you know, using Skype to connect back to the studio in Toronto.
Yeah.
We checked into the hotel with the intention of only staying a few hours. Once I did my show, we'd get back in the van and keep driving. But the cameraman and the director were tired, so they decided to take a snooze. And while I'm on the air, my cameraman starts snoring. and people were just... They were calling into the studio in Toronto like crazy, saying, you know, have you fallen asleep, or has someone fallen asleep, or what's the snoring? And it was just, hey, there's nothing you can do, you know. It's one of those things, and it's live radio, and we had a good laugh about it the following week when I found out, actually, you know, that the snoring had been heard all over North America.
That's crazy. Now, I guess one thing is kind of goofy that I wanted to mention, because you are from Toronto area, so what's your take on the whole Rob Ford thing? That guy's quite the character. Is he gonna get reelected, and you know, overall, what's your take on all that?
Well, in a very small way, I am somewhat responsible for Rob Ford being mayor.
Oh, nice.
Well, here's what happened. I was producing the morning show at AM 640. In Toronto, and Rob was sort of the lone conservative counselor on city council, and the remaining 35 or 40 counselors, or however many there are, were sort of left-leaning, left of center, and so Rob at that time, of course, as he is now, was very bombastic, and I decided to bring him on the morning show once a week.
Oh, wow.
And we called the segment "What's Eating Rob Ford?" because he was always complaining about, and rightfully so, some of the, you know, the misappropriation of funds at City Hall. They were, you know, he'd uncover things like they paid $100,000 a year to hire two people to water plants in City Hall and things like that. He was always counting pennies, which I appreciated. And being somewhat right of Attila the Hun myself, I liked him, quite frankly. So we turned this into a weekly segment. And lo and behold, Rob Ford becomes this. We gave him a platform, and he became kind of a cult hero. And, you know, he said, one day I'm going to run for mayor. And we said, yeah, sure, Rob. Why not? And in fact, before the, I don't know if you saw the YouTube parody, someone took all of the these clips from Tommy Boy and sort of strung them together and made it look like it was Rob Ford. Tommy Boy, who was that late actor from Saturday Night Live?
Chris Farley.
Chris Farley, right. Well, I used to call Rob Ford Tommy Boy because he used to come into the studio and he had that kind of that shuffle and walk, and of course, he's a hefty guy. So he reminded me of Chris Farley, so I called him, not to his face, but I used to refer to him as Tommy Boy.
Yeah.
And then that YouTube video came out. But I had left the station several years before he decided to run for mayor, but I looked back and I thought, yeah, I sort of was the one that gave him that platform. Willie, he's pretty much in a neck-and-neck tie with John Tory, the former leader of the Conservative Party of Ontario. He's not done by any stretch. And anyone who he is, I think, is in for a rude awakening. He could definitely pull this one off. It comes down to this, I think. People in Toronto would rather have an alcoholic, drug addict, or someone, how did I put it the other day, someone who drinks like a sailor versus someone who spends like one.
Mm.
They've just had it with tax and spend policies that have been the rule of the day up here in Toronto for decades upon decades upon decades. So, and there's just it's a real conundrum who to vote for, because you've got a left leaning candidate who I think would like to take us back to those tax and spend days, and then you've got John Tory, who's a very nice man, but sort of center, maybe slightly right of center, but I just don't feel it's going to get the job done. And then Rob, who's a total train wreck. I mean, what do you do? I don't know.
It's funny too, because it's ironic in a way, because he's also now he has like sort of a weird demographic, like, because he's kind of a celebrity too. So he has like this sort of. The people who will vote for him probably out of just sheer, like, kitsch value or something.
Yeah, I think when it comes, unfortunately, when it comes to most elections, 70% of it is just name recognition.
Hmm.
That may win the day for him. If he can stay out of the drunk tank for the next 4 years, then, you know, I'd be inclined. People might be cringing to hear this, but I'd be inclined to put him in again, just because we can't go back to those days of spent taxing and spending. And this city is a beautiful city. Johnny Carson had a great line when he visited here once. He said, "This is a great city if they ever get it done. It's just constantly under construction, and we're lacking sort of the serious infrastructure. We compare ourselves to New York." But we're not. We're 50 years behind in terms of public transit. We don't have the infrastructure. They should have been, you know, burrowing underground a mile every year, and they just haven't been, because the money's just been frittered away. So
weird. That's disappointing. Now, have you noticed, being Canadian, have you noticed any sort of difference in perspectives on conspiracy theory with regards to, you know, people from Canada versus Americans?
Yeah, some media types up here in Toronto think that Toronto is a hotbed of conspiracies, and that may be because there's a couple of shows, and there's a pretty prominent bookstore up here in Toronto as well called Conspiracy Culture. But I, by and large, I find Canadians have an unhealthy trust of authority, and so they are a little more reluctant, I think, to embrace a lot of conspiracy theory. versus our American friends. And I, my ancestors are from America, and I think sort of philosophically, maybe spiritually, emotionally, I consider myself to be a bit of an American. I prefer the Republican form of government, constitutional republic, and so forth.
Mm-hmm.
But there's a great line from a comedian up here by the name of Hart Pomerantz describing the difference between Americans and Canadians, and said, Americans shot their parents, we still send money home.
Yeah, that's true. I never thought of it that way, yeah. Oh, man, wow, yeah. Well, it's also, it's interesting in a sense, too, because when you think about it, especially from the way you just put it from that joke, it's like, a lot of the conspiracy theories, most of the really popular ones, like 9/11 and the JFK conspiracy theory particularly, they're American conspiracy theories. So from outside of America, I could see how the perspective might kind of be like, you don't really get it. Do you know what I mean? I'm not talking about you. I just mean like people outside of America, where they might see it and they'd be like, oh, those Americans, they can't deal with reality, or God knows what they really think. So, but it's sort of like, it's a uniquely American thing as far as these two big conspiracies go.
It's interesting. In many respects, it is. However, if you look at the foreign press, what gets – now we're comparing sort of mainstream news-gathering outlets here.
Hmm.
If you look at the North American press, they are very – there's almost a firewall around them. In that they will not acknowledge even the idea that a conspiracy is possible. And to me, it's absolutely preposterous. Thinking that nothing is a conspiracy is as ridiculous and as about as useful an idea as saying that everything is a conspiracy. But if you look at the foreign press, let's take, for example, the death of Princess Diana. We just passed the 17th anniversary, which just boggles the mind. I can't believe it's been 17 years.
Yeah.
But, for example, in places like Egypt, mainstream press there were reporting that she was likely the victim of foul play. That you just wouldn't see that kind of, even that kind of speculation in the mainstream press here.
Yeah.
So the foreign press, it's quite interesting the way that they look at conspiracy. I think they have a more honest approach to it. That conspiracies happen. Two people get in a room and they conspire to do something illegal. A conspiracy, as our friend Jim Marr says, is not a theory; it's a crime. So I think the rest of the world may report on these things as sort of political subterfuge or politics as usual, whereas we here in the West call it conspiracy.
Hmm. That makes sense. Yeah. Yeah. Plus, there seems to be also like this distrust of, America's always kind of up to something nefarious or shady. So I can see why other countries would also be like, well, we know you guys are, you got your hand in a lot of cookie jars, so who knows what you're really up to.
Well, I appreciate the American culture and its healthy mistrust of authority. I wish we had a little bit more of that up here, quite frankly. So it is part of the culture. I mean, the nation was forged in overthrowing tyranny. We talk a lot about that on the show, as does Coast to Coast, abuse of power, which kind of falls under the rubric of conspiracy, but it's not really. I mean, we know it's happening. The erosion of civil rights and political subterfuge, which we call conspiracy, but it's just the way the world is run, unfortunately. I think Americans just have their antenna up for that kind of thing.
Hmm. But we, just to circle back to kind of what I was saying before, it's like, I feel like there's a begrudging distrust of authority in a sense. People just don't want to do anything anymore about it. Do you know what I mean? I find that it's very troubling in a sense where, I mean, well, you see, like I talked about how it seems like we may have lost the whole battle. It's like, look at that whole Ferguson thing. The only way to defeat these authority figures is to, like, shame them now. Shame them for their misuse of their authority. That seems to be the only way to actually succeed, because like an uprising of any sort of revolutionary sense, it seems, futile.
Yeah, there is, unfortunately, a resignation. One would hope that, with a realization and an awakening, there would be a call to action. But and people like Alex Jones and others, Jesse Ventura, might argue, well, this is exactly what these unelected oligarchs had in mind, is to just bombard our psyches with bad news and running down politicians and government, and so that we ultimately just despair and throw our hands up and say, well, there's nothing we can do about it, and then they've got us, because that's exactly what they want.
Well, so, yeah, I think maybe just to hammer home the point that had never really occurred to me until I was just talking to you about it, but it does seem like public activism and sort of calling out the authority for misuse of their power may be the most effective tool too. At the same time, because it seems like eventually, if you can get public opinion behind something, it really helps to make change, and hopefully that can be used to a greater good. Like, you kind of saw it a little bit with like the whole NSA thing, but it kind of died out. People they were outraged, but they didn't really know what to do about it. But I think the more pressure you put on the power structure to be more honest, and if you can kind of get the groundswell going, maybe it helps. We'll switch gears a little bit. Let's talk about some of the more paranormal elements of stuff you've explored. Is there any particular, realm of the paranormal that you find, really interesting? Like, my kind of bailiwick is UFOs. I've always found that to be the most prominent of stuff that stood out to me that I've kind of really dug my heels into and tried to explore. But is there anything in that realm that's particularly interesting to you?
Well, likewise, UFOs obviously is a huge area, and I conducted a little kind of a marketing tool on my website. I asked people to vote for the sort of their favorite subject area or field, and I had about 18 topics, everything from UFOs to political assassinations, GMOs, fluoride, chemtrails, secret societies, end times prophecy, all that.
Yeah.
And far and away, the number one topic is UFOs and ETs. People cannot get enough of it. And if Dolan were here, he'd say this is the most important issue of our time, maybe the most important issue of all time, as to, who are they, what are they, why are they here, and is the government keeping a lid on all this? So, yeah, UFOs, I came late to that dance because I don't know why, but I didn't really get into into that subject matter until I hooked up with a guy here in Toronto who's a UFO disclosure advocate called Victor Vigiani, and he sort of dragged me kicking and screaming into this area. And I don't know, I can't even remember what my reticence was at the time. I guess maybe I didn't know how to wrap my head around it. How do you wrap your head around, 150 million people have seen one of these things since 1947, according to a UN report. What do you do with that? And all these reams of government documents showing that they're concerned about UFOs, and they've scrambled jets to intercept UFOs, and it's a tough one for me, because it doesn't, again, coming back to my faith filter, there are some difficulties there with that, so I have to try and figure out how does that fit, the UFO issue, how does that fit into, for example, the biblical narrative.
Yeah.
So, what amazes me about the UFO ET issue is how many different levels or layers there are to it. If you're talking about something like Bigfoot, it's just a question, well, does it or doesn't it exist? And you have field researchers out there trying to collect samples, and George Knapp had a terrific interview the other night with this woman who's, sent these DNA samples out to labs, and they've all come back positive. This is an unknown species and so forth. But that's about all there is to it, as far as I can tell. But with UFOs, there's the alien technology, free energy, which sort of dovetails with, you know, the big oil,
right,
and big pharma, and then you've got the whole disclosure aspect and the Majestic 12 and Area 51 and Wright-Patterson, and it just goes on and on. There are so many sort of threads, and they're interwoven in such an incredible web that you could spend 1,000 lifetimes just trying to untangle this thing.
Yeah, yeah. It's like what's really going on could run a whole spectrum of stuff that ranges just a completely wide range. You know, it's like the government may know absolutely nothing, or the government may know everything, and they may be working in cahoots with the aliens, or somewhere in between. It's like you don't have any idea. It's really it's a very maddening subject, and I don't know about you, but it's like when you talk about the mass of information, it's very frustrating that it's still such a put upon concept. You would think by now, like you were talking about the international media, like being a little more open about conspiracy theories and stuff, but it's still, UFOs still remains this really taboo thing to treat with an honest look.
Yeah. I think that's changing. Again, we look at the foreign press. They take this very seriously in places like France and Italy and Brazil and Canada and the United States continue to treat this topic with that sort of idiotic, tongue-in-cheek, chortle, crazy lady down the street saw, you know, some lights in the sky last night, which, you know, just makes me believe that there may be more to this whole disclosure aspect than we're led to believe, that at some level, and there's a glass ceiling, and part of me thinks reporters just know, in terms of career, in terms of job security, it's not something that they're supposed to touch or at least handle in a serious manner.
Mm.
But part of me also thinks, you know, we know from the Rolling Stone magazine piece back in the late 70s, it was written by all the King's men, Washington Post reporter, Watergate. Help me out, Tim. I'm 50. My brain cells.
Woodward and Bernstein?
Yes. It was Woodward, I think. No, it was Carl Bernstein, who talked about the infiltration of intelligence groups into mainstream news gathering services. And I believe that. I mean, I don't even think it's an arguable or disputable fact at this point. At some level, I'm tending to believe that someone's, you know, pulling some strings and saying you will not cover that, or you can cover it, but we're not going to follow it up. You know, this 24-hour news cycle is crazy. Like, we could be told one day, in fact, we were told, Edgar Mitchell, sixth man to walk on the moon. He was touring, I think, in London at the time. Is going back, I think, mid to early 90s, and he said that everything we've heard about, you know, aliens and UFOs and Roswell is true, and I've been told by top-level people at the Pentagon and people at NASA and so forth. And that made a huge splash in the news for about 24 hours. And then it was gone. Like, where's the follow-up? How do you put that out there and then just leave it there and not follow up? It'd be like being told that there is a killer asteroid hurtling towards Earth, a planet killer. There's nothing we can do about it. And then the next day, nothing. They don't talk about it anymore.
Yeah. Yeah, it's really weird. You wonder if like sort of the motivation of the journalists gets dampened too, in the sense, like you're saying, they're not going to follow up on it. So I guess if you're the journalist, you're like, well, why should I bother writing this story about UFOs? Or why should I even look into this? Because it's never going to gain any traction. And, you know, even beyond the ridicule factor, it's like, why? It's a dead-end story. You know, so why chase it, it seems? Maybe that might be part of the mindset.
Yeah, you're definitely onto something, Tim. It's the peer pressure or losing respective colleagues and so forth. You know, former KGB officer, I think his name was Primakov, actually ended up advising Homeland Security after the Iron Curtain fell, and after 9/11 he came over. And Primakov was blown away at the way that information is controlled in the media here. He was actually, kind of jealous. He said, we took gulags to do that. We had to have, people thrown into exile in gulags. And you don't need any of that. You just ostracize people, and it works far more effectively.
Yeah, yeah. Well, it's like it seems like they figured out how to create a sort of tyrannical government control of the world, the American way or the Western way. Is like you do it by not doing it by brute force, by just wearing
right.
people down and sort of just distracting them with also entertainment type crap.
Sure, bread and circuses. It's I call it the fur-lined trap. We're in cages. We're slaves. We're in a cage, but they're such well-appointed cages. We've got all the toys we need, who's willing to give that up?
Yeah,
we almost welcome, that kind of imprisonment. And the other thing with the fur-lined trap is if you're a, let's say you're a White House correspondent, and you're sending your kids to a nice private school, maybe in Georgetown or Washington or somewhere in Virginia. You've got beautiful wife, beautiful house, or beautiful, handsome husband, as the case may be. A couple of cars in the garage. You've got all the toys you need. Life is good. Why would you risk that by putting up your hand and asking a potentially damaging question to the president?
Yeah, yeah. No, it makes perfect sense from their perspective. So all we're left with the people like, the rabble rousers, like like you and I, who can't get a meeting with the president, unfortunately, but. Do you think that we're going to see any kind of breakthrough in all this? Because, I mean, like, you've been doing this for a long time. I've been doing this for a long time at this point. I've been looking at this for 11 years now. You've obviously been at this whole thing a lot longer than I have. It's very frustrating in a sense. You wonder if we're ever going to get any sort of breakthrough or if it's just going to be the slow evolution of the idea and, hope that maybe the next generation will come along and they'll change things.
Yeah, it's just a kind of a never-ending parade of empires, and we're sort of sitting back and watching empires rise and then collapse, and then another one comes along and takes its place. So this has been going on for 5,000 years, I guess. And ultimately, again, I believe it will end, but I don't know how close we are to midnight. I mean...
Well, I meant the UFO mystery, though. I meant, do you think we'll get a breakthrough, do you think we'll ever get, any kind of clear-cut answer to all this, or do you think it'll always be sort of teased out to people, for our lifetime?
Well, assuming that there is there's a vast, complex system in place to keep a lid on it, what's at stake? Why have they exerted so much effort and spent probably, trillions of dollars to keep a lid on this thing. Whatever the reason is, and whether it has to do with free energy or some breakaway civilization, as Dolan describes it, that, they want all the alien technology and they may even, in fact, be off-planet by now, which is why they don't give a tinker's damn about what goes on down here. I don't see them giving that up anytime soon without any good reason.
Yeah.
So no, I mean, I don't think we're going to get disclosure from the president. I don't think the president has it in his power. I don't think he's got even the security clearance. I don't think he's in the loop.
Yeah, yeah. I certainly don't think the president would even have the ability or the power to do that sort of thing. Well, I guess here's an interesting sort of perspective on things. Maybe because I'm sure you've talked to a lot of folks up there in Canada. Because the American quote-unquote knowledge of UFOs has this incredible, narrative that's gone on. We don't even know what's true and what's not, but it's good. The canon. It's like a comic book. It's this vast history of various characters and theories and stories and stuff. What's the situation up there in Canada? What do the people who research UFOs think the situation is? What do they think the Canadian government knows about all this?
Well, funny you should ask, because the former defense minister up here, Paul Hellyer, In fact, he was deputy prime minister, so he was a heartbeat away from becoming the prime minister back in the 70s when he was deputy prime minister to Pierre Elliott Trudeau. And then he was defense minister in the 1960s, not a very popular one for a host of reasons, but very bright, learned fellow, now in his late 80s. And about 5 or 6 years ago, after he had been out of office for some time, my friend Victor Vigiani, who I mentioned earlier, convinced the Right Honorable Paul Hellyer to stand up in public and proclaim his knowledge of UFOs and alien interaction with human civilization. And he did that at great risk, you know, to his legacy. There's no reason why he needed to do that. But Paul Hellyer has had conversations with unnamed U.S. high-ranking military officials. And now, he wasn't privy to any of this while he was defense minister or while he was deputy prime minister, but he, again, was told that everything we've heard about Roswell and alien bodies and back-engineered alien technology, everything is true and more. That's a direct quote. Everything is true and more. So that really, I think at the time, Hellyer was the highest-ranking government official to ever go on the record to say something like that.
Yeah.
So that caused quite a stir up here. But again, you know, it got a little bit of news coverage and kind of a tongue-in-cheek treatment. Well, the poor old doddering fool, he's in his 80s after all. You know, we can't expect him to be of sound mind, which was incredibly disrespectful. I mean, I've talked to Paul Hellyer on a number of occasions, and he may be 88 or 89, but he's got a mind like a steel trap.
Yeah.
I think we look at the UFO issue sort of through the American lens, because again we look back to Roswell just as you do, or the the Battle of Los Angeles, or any of these high profile UFO sightings. So I think we do have our own sort of Canadian experiences. We have a very famous UFO incident that happened in 1967 in Atlantic Canada called Shag Harbor.
Oh, yeah.
Where a UFO was seen by military police. It landed, crash-landed in Shag Harbor on the water. They scrambled rescue teams. It was a mass sighting. And
very famous case.
Military people, RCMP, there's a government document trail. It's all there. I mean, I think it is one of the few UFO incidents to actually be called a UFO incident in a government document.
Oh, wow. That's pretty amazing.
Yeah, so, and then tons of sightings up here, of course.
So you said Paul Hellyer didn't hear about, because I read the story a while ago, and like you said, it's like, feel bad, because it got buried in a sense. It should have been like the Edward Snowden type thing. It should have been something that like launched a massive, media wave. But it never did. So I'm fuzzy on the details here. But you said he didn't hear about all this stuff when he was the deputy prime minister. When did he hear about all the UFO stuff?
What happened was someone sent him a copy of Phil Corso's book the day after Roswell.
Oh, okay.
And he read it, was intrigued by it, started calling some former colleagues down in the United States, unnamed at this point.
Hmm.
Again, including some high-ranking military people, and at least some of them or one of them confided in him. They said, yes, it's all true.
Oh, man. I wish those people would speak up, then.
Yeah, I mean, we need names. We need names.
Hmm.
If we're going to move this thing forward, we need more people like Paul Hellyer coming forward. But, I mean, Hellyer is hearing about it second or third hand.
Right, right. Yeah, he's just getting the info from here. So, but you're right. We need more people to speak out about it. More people who know stuff. you'd hope that would help, but I've grown very pessimistic about what might break this thing open as far as UFOs go, unless it's, we need like another big event, you know. It seems like we haven't, I know Stephenville was big, but that's going on, that's been a long time now since that happened. So you hope for like some crazy event that's going to really galvanize the public again.
Yeah, I don't know. What more is needed? We have, going back to Stephenville, we have police officers saying, yeah, I saw it. It was so large it obliterated the night sky. It was like a box store hovering above me silently. What more do we need? You have police officers. You have ex-presidents. You have congressmen. You have scientists. You have very credible people who have seen these things up close multiple times, and yet that's not good enough. I mean, they leave. You know, we have radar corroborating what people say they saw from the ground. So, I'm like you. I don't hold out much hope that this is we're ever going to get any formal acknowledgement. But do we really need that even? I mean, we know it's enough that we know. Do we actually need some bureaucrat standing at the National Press Gallery acknowledging what many or most of us have accepted for a very long time?
Right.
I guess
right.
Part of us, we do. We need that. We need that vindication or acknowledgement, perhaps.
Yeah, it's kind of like I think the society or reality needs like the switch to be flipped, where it's okay to deal with all this stuff. I think that's the bigger issue. You know what I mean? It's like how it happens if a UFO crashes in in Cowboy Stadium or something like that, then that'll change. You know, we just need something to sort of flip that switch over. But I've talked about this on the show before. I mean, maybe you can sort of give me your thoughts on this conundrum that faces the UFO issue, and that's that, you know, like the old shampoo commercial says, you never get a second chance to make a first impression. And the UFOs had their chance to make the first impression in the 40s and the 50s and the 60s, and they kind of blew their first impression. You know, through nefarious help from the U.S.
Right,
government,
right.
But you know what I mean. It's like the idea of UFOs is already people have already made their minds up about it, and we're in a hole as far as those of us who are trying to get people to change their minds or at least open their minds to it. We're in a deep hole here as far as trying to change that public relations baggage that it carries.
Yeah, which leads into a whole host of other questions. I mean, how many. ET civilizations are we dealing with? Some of which don't care to make an impression. Others could care less. The other question is how are they going to? And I say they, the government or whomever. How are they going to come out and say, all right, yes, we've lied to you for the last 70 years, but now believe us when we tell you this, and this is what's going on. And also, people have paid with their lives for trying to either they paid trying to uncover the truth, or they've died as a result of this cover-up. For example, you look at the astronauts that died during the Mercury rocket program, or even the shuttle program. Why are we still using highly volatile rocket fuel to propel people up into space if, for example, we've had anti-gravitics for the last 50 years, as some speculate.
Mm.
But that's been kept from us. So they, whoever they are, they've got blood on their hands. So for them now to come forward and acknowledge that, it puts them in a bit of a precarious situation, which has led some people on the UFO disclosure side to say, well, we need to offer them amnesty. If we're ever going to get that acknowledgement, we have to at least promise them, well, we're not going to prosecute them for crimes against humanity or murder or what have you.
How do we? Who has the right to do that, though? Who can speak up and say you have amnesty?
There you go. Yeah, you see, it's just such a convoluted, complex issue.
Hmm. Yeah. You almost you know, we talk about the Armageddon, that whole idea, but you almost wonder if it's going to take some kind of, like, I remember, I forget his name now, he passed away, I feel bad. The guy, he was, Tortuga was his website, and he pushed for the moon calendar, and I was a big fan of switching to a moon calendar. But
I know who you mean.
It escapes me, but I'll maybe someone in the chat can come up with it. But the point being that I think he argued that, like, it was already too late, but he was like, 9/11 would have been a great time to institute the moon calendar. Like, when things stop, we need, like, a change to actually, we need, like, a point to catch our breath, then maybe things can change and, you know, we can
hit the reset button.
Yes, yeah. Exactly, reset button. So.
On the other hand, you know, if this thing is this thing, meaning the UFO issue, an ET issue, is laid to rest, you know, maybe you and I and George Norrie and the rest will all be out of work. I mean, once this becomes, and I often wonder, you know, some of the stuff that we talk about, Tim, is some of it anyway, is becoming a little more palatable for the mainstream. And I remember the Washington Post at the end of 2013, we're doing a year-end review of the year that was, and of course that was the year of Snowden and so forth.
Mm.
And the headline that ran was 2013, the year that proved your paranoid friends are right. And I thought, yeah, you know, it's getting to the point where a lot of the stuff that I talk about on my show, or maybe it gets discussed on Coast and maybe that you talk about, more and more people are just sort of accepting of these things, and it's not like we're doing this subversive, you know, pirate radio anymore. It's going mainstream.
Yeah, that's absolutely true. Yeah. I was talking about that with Greg Bishop on our year interview show, that the Snowden story was like a big win for the conspiracy community, which is good because we need a win every now and again. We need a big win, so, you know, it's a difficult challenge, this whole field, which brings me to 9/11. Now, you've been in this, you predate 9/11, presumably, right?
By a couple of years, yes.
Okay, yeah. So what's your take, because I find this interesting, and I like to get different guests' opinions, especially folks who delve a lot in conspiracy. Just looking at it as a whole, you know, not the event itself, but you know, the attempts to unravel what really happened. What do you think of, like, sort of the birth and the evolution and what looks like sort of the stagnation of this community that rose on 9/11, of you know, the 9/11 truth community, as it's called?
Yeah, stagnation is a great a term. We were just talking about the UFO issue, and I see some parallels. You know, you've got, let's say, for example, you've got the MUFON groups out there, which they're wonderful people, volunteers, and they're out there and they're trying to catalog these sightings. But if you talk to MUFON people about alien abductions or crop circles or, you know, whatever, close encounters of the third kind, they don't want to hear about it. They say, no, you're way too, you know, down, you know, you're going too down, far down the road. You're ahead of the curve here. We're not prepared to talk about that. And there's a lot of that sort of same mentality, unfortunately, in the 9/11 truther movement, where they get married to certain ideas and it becomes like a religion. Let's say, for example, controlled demolition. So, for example, you know, I've stated on my program a number of times that I'm not convinced anymore that it was controlled demolition. How do you wire 110-story buildings, 210-story buildings, without somebody noticing? Can you imagine the amount of cable you'd have to string and so forth?
Right. There had to be a janitor lurking around there that would have seen something.
Exactly. But, I mean, the whole notion that 9/11 was an inside job doesn't rise and fall on controlled demolition, but they don't see it that way. So if you attack controlled demolition or you question it, suddenly they start treating you the way sort of the mainstream media has been treating the 9/11 crowd in general.
Hmm.
So the slaves become the oppressor. And that's unfortunate. It's, to me, the whole logistics of how it happened has become paramount to the movement's detriment. It's like counting blades of grass on the grassy knoll. You know, it's not that important important ultimately in the big picture.
Mm.
How the buildings were brought down, you know, what did these jets actually fly into the towers? Was it a hologram? You know, the means is not so important. The motive is important.
Yeah.
The opportunity is also important. And I don't think we spend enough time talking about the motive and the opportunity, and we spend too much time talking about the means. And the, some conspiracy-minded would say, yes, that's the whole idea, you know, that the these intelligence groups and so forth have infiltrated these groups, and they've got us all running around chasing our tails and fighting each other. There's so much infighting now in the 9/11 movement, just like there is in the UFO community. And in the Bigfoot community, I'm sure it's in whatever, you know, you name the cause, and there's a civil war going on.
Yeah.
And that's where we're at with 9/11.
Yeah. And it's frustrating because, you know, like what I said, I mean, we saw it begin, and you almost think, like, you look back at the JFK assassination and you think, well, you know, maybe this time we'll get it right. As far as, like, the conspiracy research community goes. Like, maybe this time, maybe this will be the one we actually get that works. But it didn't. It kind of, it was really ground up by the media in a lot of ways. It's surprising. I mean, you do see some sort of coverage of it, but it's really an interesting way the media covers it in a lot of ways. They definitely dismiss anybody who talks about it or dares to talk about anything beyond the mainstream story as a total, like, kook. Or they quickly dismiss the whole idea.
Yeah, it's become the it's kissing the third rail. Whether you're a politician, I noted with interest the other night that Ron Paul has finally come out and started talking about, you know, foreknowledge of the event and whether it was in part an inside job. Now Ron Paul never talked about that when he was on the campaign trail, and I understand why. Again, it's the third rail. But now that he's no longer running for office, he's got nothing to lose. So, you know, he's starting to open up and acknowledge that. You know, once if you're inside and you're trying to operate within the system, you cannot go there. You cannot go there. Once you're on the outside, and you have a certain amount of freedom. It's like, let's say, for example, climate change. If you talk to tenured professors, they will not stray from sort of the orthodox mindset about, you know, man-made or anthropogenic global warming. But if you talk to retired professors, recently retired professors even, they start to open up and they'll say, yeah, the data's been fudged, or this just, you know, it doesn't make any sense, and I never believed it did, but I was afraid to say so, and so forth. So, yeah, it's almost like you need to divorce in order to be able to talk about these things.
Yeah. It's a challenge. It really is a challenge. It seems like we operate in two different worlds, not you and I, but the people who are chasing after these mysteries, and then the people that are responsible, I guess you could say, for educating and entertaining the general public, which is the general media. It's like we're in a double competing worlds. Although, thankfully, it seems like the mainstream media, people are turning more to alternative media, which is great. You know, they're getting more and more people who, well, I mean, like, I kind of bagged on Alex Jones earlier, but I got to give him credit. He's gone from just, like, some little regional radio host to an international name that people recognize.
Yeah, people are voting with their feet. They're not getting the kind of information. You know, I sit and I watch the 6 o'clock news, and I often scratch my head and say, "Who put that lineup together? Like, how many of those stories do I care about?" You know, or I saw those same stories last week or every year. You know, on Labor Day they trot out the same stories. They're not covering the stuff that I'm interested in or that I care about. And obviously, I'm not alone in that. People are voting with their feet, and they're walking away from daily newspapers and magazines and network news. And, yeah, they're finding that information elsewhere. And that's one institution I'm not sad to see crumble, you know.
What's that? The mainstream media?
Well, the mainstream, the fifth estate or the fourth estate or whatever you want to call it, they've walked off the playing field. They lay down and quit on us. I remember was it May 2010 or May 2011 when Osama bin Laden was supposedly found and killed, and I knew 3 or 4 year olds that were asking more intelligent questions about, why can't we see pictures or where's the DNA and why did they bury him at sea so quickly and all of this, and where were the reporters, where were the journalists covering that story? I understand, after 9/11 and the war on terror, there's a certain amount of rally around the flag. We are, first Americans or Canadians sometimes, and then journalists second. But just a total absence of critical thinking, by and large, when many of these incidents happen.
Mm.
And I just get the feeling that many of these people that are supposedly journalists, I wouldn't trust them to cover a house fire, let alone 9/11 or... the war on terror, or be embedded, in Syria or Iraq.
Yeah.
I don't trust that they're going to get the job done. They're going to ask the questions that need to be asked.
Right, right. Especially the ones that are sort of, you say embedded in the conflict, but the ones especially who are embedded in their role wherever they are, the Washington Post or the New York Times or something like that. It's like you said, they're not going to risk their kids' college education or something like that. They reach a point where it's like they don't. It's the opposite of tenure. It's like they're at an age where they can't risk being fired. So
that's right. That's right. Don't rock the boat. Don't rock the boat. And I often think that if Woodward and Bernstein were covering Watergate today, and I mean my Lord, Watergate is compared to what's going on now. If Watergate happened today, it might get passing, a coverage, maybe 24 hours, but certainly the president wouldn't resign. But if it was a big deal and Woodward and Bernstein were trying to uncover it today, they would be subjected to the same kind of snide remarks from their colleagues that those people that are trying to investigate 9/11 or what have you are being treated that way today. Woodward and Bernstein would be laughed out of the room. I'm convinced of that.
Oh, absolutely. Especially because it's one of those the truth is stranger than fiction type stories.
Right.
Where it's
right.
No one would even, they'd be like, get out of here, dude. That's go on go on Banal of America and talk about that stuff. That's crazy talk.
Right. Now a reporter would go up to he'd get an interview with the president. The president would say, "Well, this is just ridiculous, and I deny it." And then the reporter would go back and he'd report, "Well, the president has denied it, and that's good enough for me."
Yeah. It was Dr. Jose Arguelles who we were talking about with the moon calendar. So
yes, yeah, he sort of totally popularized the idea of the Mayan calendar and a lot of that. Yeah.
Yeah. Yeah.
What could cause that? Clearly aliens can cause that, as happened in Roswell, New Mexico, as happens in a television show I like called The Event. You have to face facts that aliens are all around us, and they have finally gotten to the NHL.
You're listening to Banal of America Audio.
Creepy. That's what this is. You pointed out that I spent a lot of time in Dallas, 20 years, working just a few blocks away from the grassy knoll, the book depository.
So you're a conspiracist.
And the conspiracy museum, which,
right,
oddly enough, has been closed down now. Conspiracy? Could be. Something odd is going on here.